Hello, everybody, and welcome to the ABCs of Green Politics. And amazingly, after 3 years, we have now reached ABC, and we're looking at X. And X is not for xenomorph or X-rays, although they will probably make fascinating areas to discuss. But X standing for xenophobia, and in particular, the rise of the right, which, you know, you want to be lying under a ditch dead not to notice the rise of fascism and far-right populism, you know, often enabled by, well, social democracy or the centre-right, take your pick, we make it into that. But particularly in terms of the appropriation by the far-right of climate politics, and most recently, the rise of farmers' protest movements across Europe, including in Ireland, and the ways in which we can see some ugly elements abusing sometimes the right, the righteous and the, you know, the appropriate anger amongst our farming community about how they often are left behind in terms of the ecological transition. So to join me today to look at X is for xenophobia and the far right and climate and land use politics is a good friend and comrade, Stefano Nulon, who's one of the hosts of the most excellent The Worker's Guide to Everything and a member of Trademark Belfast. So you're very welcome, Stefan.
Cheers, John. Excuse me. I'm just taking a slug of coffee there. Been on Zooms all fucking day, but pleasure to be here and lovely to see you again.
So let's kick off, Stefan, in terms of your own perspective, in terms of, you know, where you see the fault lines, particularly, you know, you look at what's going on in Germany, in the Netherlands, you see the rise of farmer protests, but also in Ireland, particularly where you see the far right moving in to either colonize or abuse and use it as a jumping off point.
Well, I mean, it's one of the most standout features of contemporary politics, isn't it? The rise of the right. And I know it feels like it's a recent thing, but when you look at the stats, particularly in Europe, if we can be a little bit Eurocentric for the moment, far right parties have been on the rise since the early 1980s, politically speaking, electorally speaking. So they were like 1 or 2% back in the 80s, they're now 15, 20, 25% and higher. And if you look at the graph in the 80s, it's kind of been a steady rise of far-right parties. So you could argue that, yes, of course, 2008 and the global financial crash was kind of accelerated that growth of far-right parties. But they're a product of neoliberalism. They're a product of this latest version of capitalism, which has failed workers and failed communities and failed the environment from its very beginning. And because of that, people are looking elsewhere, or people are more vulnerable, I should say, to the kind of narratives, to far-right narratives. And there's a big issue there about how and why we've let that happen. What's happened to socialist parties? What's happened to social democratic parties? And one of my bugbears, and we'll get onto this, I know, is it increasingly looks, if you stand outside, kind of back and look in, it looks like social democratic and socialist parties are defending the status quo. That's what it looks like. They're defending a system which destroys communities, destroys the environment, destroys workers. And it looks, it's not real, of course. And then the radical right can step into that space and say, we're the true breakers of the status quo. We're the true revolutionaries. We're the true radicals. And we're sitting defending fucking neoliberalism. And that's one of the biggest problems we have, is that we've forgotten how to think like socialists. We've forgotten how to act like revolutionaries. That's been exacerbated now in debates around the climate, if you like. It doesn't mean that we can't have change. So anyway, that's my bugbear, is that product of neoliberalism, and one of the problems is where's the left in all of this, and the left seems to be defending what's indefensible, and we haven't moved on from that position yet. We're still stuck there.
No, I think you're bang on the money there, and also then the ways in which particularly climate and sustainability policies are framed as very technocratic, top down, very little, inclusion of the communities that are affected, and particularly on the island of Ireland, for those of you who are not aware, that our biggest challenge, and is unique, certainly in Europe, if not the so-called advanced world or the imperialist core, is that our challenge on the island of Ireland around greenhouse gas emissions is not going to be in transport or energy, you know, although they're going to be challenging. It is land use. It's largely to do with the fact that the island of Ireland has an unsustainable cow herd, effectively. We have a beef and dairy industry that is producing, methane, which is a much more climate potent gas than carbon, although it's a significant carbon impact of agriculture and land use. So I'm wondering, Stefan, in terms of, you know, have you seen any debate, particularly, say, within the trade union movement? You know, the trade union movement on the island has written some documents, or at least, you know, FORSA and I don't know, Unite, I know, have written documents about the just transition. And that's largely been around, you know, like the boredom of owner workers, which, you know, is an important issue, or what are we going to do with displaced fossil fuel workers, whether it's in Aberdeen in Scotland or Kilroot Power Station here in the north. But I'm just wondering, because, you know, you're really involved in the trade union movement. Is there any evidence that the Irish trade union movement is, A, you know, cottoning on to the importance of, you know, if we're going to deal with the climate crisis, we have to deal with land and land use and ownership, and particularly agriculture and new agricultural systems on the island. But then connected with that, as you've mentioned, is the rise of the right. So these two things are connected now together. But is there any evidence of the Irish trade union movement really starting to understand this?
I mean, there are a few little pieces of work being done here and there, as you mentioned, with Force and some other unions. But broadly speaking, the labour movement, which I'm a part, have been for 30 years, is kind of asleep at the wheel. I mean, obviously, the labour movements generally aren't revolutionary movements. You don't look to the labour movement to provide the kind of answers that we need to see. But there are very good people in the labour movement doing their best. But the labour movement, it's kind of behind, you know, it's a product of capitalism. It exists because capitalism exists. So I sometimes think you never look to the labour movement for the kind of answers we want to see. The other problem we have is that the questions we're dealing with are so massive and they're so big. I'm not sure that any social movement, any group's quite ready to deal with the levels of changes we're going to need to see in the next 50 to 100 years in order to transform the world economy. Because I think I read somewhere that you're looking at epoch-level changes in the next 100 years. The transition from where we are now to where we generally need to be is as big as the transition from pre-capitalist societies to capitalist societies back in the 17th century. So it's massive changes in every aspect of our lives. And the problem we have is that we're not really having those conversations yet. You know, as you said, we're tinkering around the edges of some small technocratic changes to how we currently do capitalism. That's really what is moving to perhaps more green versions of capitalism. And that really won't do. You know that as well as I do. And the problem with that is because there's no really deep analysis and conversation happening on the left or in the labour movement about the kinds of changes we need to see, that allows space for others to step in and provide their narrative and provide their stories. And the far right, of course, have been sitting in the wings waiting for 30 years, and this is the perfect opportunity to step into that space. People are scared, they're vulnerable, they're worried. We're not providing the answers. We're not providing the answers, really, I would argue. And so they're stepping into that space and providing the wrong analysis with the wrong answers, but it nonetheless is their answers of a kind. And they're doing that in rural areas in Ireland quite successfully at the moment. That's the problem. And no one else is in there talking about rural transition or just transitions or what happens to farming if we reduce our herd from 5 million to 3 or to 2 or whatever those changes might be. And that's the problem, is that everyone's afraid to have the debate. So no one's having the debate and others are stepping into that space. And so we really got to grasp on that, I think, and have a serious debate about what we're going to do with land and food production. And I certainly don't see it come from the labour movement. I'm sorry to disappoint you, John.
No, I mean, on the one hand, you have, you know, the increasing, in my view, scientific evidence that there are no non-radical solutions left. I mean, you know, when you read the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change or the UN General Secretary Antonio Guterres, and what they're saying is that, you know, we need to move beyond growth. We need to seriously question the capitalist organization of our economy. And that's not for ideological reasons. You know, that's for purely scientific reasons, that a planned, managed wind down of the carbon energy system and a more rational, you know, mobilization of society's resources is now, you know, functionally required. And that's coming from the scientists, as it were. So it's really, you know, sad to say the least, that at the very time when the labor movement and socialists could use science now to back up ideological arguments, you know, we make a less unequal society, less injustice and so on, they're not grasping that nettle. And so there's an issue there of the lack of basic, I don't know, political understanding of the science that's now available. The evidence base is now there to argue for an eco-socialist planned economy in a way that it perhaps wasn't there before. But on the other hand, this is a more difficult issue, is that for rural communities or even urban communities, you know, it is not necessarily racist or xenophobic to have concerns about immigration, to have concerns about refugees coming into your area. And again, I say that often with a sense of trepidation, because people listen to this, oh my God, you know, I'm coming out with some sort of justification. It isn't. It's about we cannot go into working class communities, rural or urban, with an assumption that those out on the streets, perhaps protesting against the siting of a refugee center, are necessarily racist. They're looking for answers, as you said. And they're often being manipulated and given the wrong answers and information by those on the right. But I do think it is about, and I know you've worked in this area in terms of on the groundwork that Trademark does, about how do we enter that conversation with those rural or even working class communities that are now, the epicentres of these, anti-immigrant sentiment and actions.
It's a different one. It's a challenging one. There's two things. One thing is sometimes you look at social media and you think you've lost the world. It's hard, but we haven't. I mean, it's just small groups of people. There's still huge work being done across Ireland welcoming refugees, asylum seekers, migrant workers into areas well integrated, attending local schools, attending Bond School, and being bi and trilingual at home and in communities. There's great stories across Ireland. We tend not to see those stories. So whilst we shouldn't underestimate the threat of the far right, we shouldn't over-egg the pudding either and say these people are taking over, because they're not. I mean, they're not at all. And that's not to say that racism hasn't become acceptable in public parlance. That's not to say that racist attacks haven't increased and anti-immigrants haven't. All of that's on the rise, but we have to not become so kind of scared that we lose our hope in the issue. In terms of talking to working class communities, I mean, someone in a German political party, let's call that one on the left, asked me once, how do you access these people? And I went, what do you mean these people? You mean my mum, my fucking sister, me? I mean, I consider myself to be working class. What do you mean these? But it spoke of the thing that's happened across the left in the last 30 years. In Europe now, this doesn't refer to Latin, South America, Africa, Asia, but particularly in Europe, where the left has retreated into the academy or treated into kind of cult-like political organisations that have no roots in working-class communities, that have no base in working-class communities. I include the labour movement in that, by the way. We used to have centres in communities, centres, buildings, trade union offices all around the place, and we've kind of withdrawn from working-class communities. And there's almost like a geographical gap now between left-wing centres, if you want to call it that, or spaces, and where the working fucking class live, that we're not rooted there anymore. And that's a real problem, and that's a problem of the left. And that stems, once again, I'll go back to it, from the left, particularly in Europe, rather than seeing parliamentary politics as a road to socialism, saw it as an end in itself. Get into politics, tinker around with the system, we'll take the worst edges off neoliberalism, and we'll all be good. And that clearly hasn't fucking worked. But the left has hamstrung itself and doesn't now know how to re-engage with those communities, and that's a problem. To the point where, I don't give a fuck, I'll say it. Even left-wing spaces have become spaces where working people can't go into because they're policed about how they say it, what they say, what they fucking wear, how they speak. And if you want to join the left, eco-socialist left, whichever bit of it you belong to, you've got to jump through about 500 different hoops to get into it. Where's the right to say, what? Who do you hate? Come in. Fucking door's open, mate. Just come in here. You have to jump through hoops to join. That's the point. And we make it really hard for people to join. And when you look at one of the most successful tactics of the far right in the last 10 years, is that they accuse us of being part of the elite, that we're just technocratics, that we're preachy, that we tell them what to do. And some of that's true. You know what I mean? And the right doesn't do any of that. You know what I mean? They don't preach at people. They don't tell people how to behave. And I'm not excusing homophobic, transphobic, racist, sectarian fucking behavior. But there are ways to do that in ways that don't kind of marginalize people. So I think we've forgotten how to speak to people. And I think that's a big issue we have. I'm not entirely sure whether we're ready to deal with that one. But that's also not to say the working class isn't fucking diverse and black and, and brown and gender. I mean, it's a diverse working class. So I don't think we should fall into the trap of equating working class meaning white either, which is also dangerous on the left. Some people do that. But there's no doubt we've got a lot of work to do in terms of community organizing and being present in communities. Because if we're not present in those communities, the right will be. And in fact, the right are.
No, I think in a way you reflect something that, we can certainly see in the way in which the left has gravitated towards issues of identity politics. Somebody said to me, when the left is more concerned about the former racist slave owner, that's the name of the street, and not concerned about the joblessness of the people living on the street, there's a problem. It's so much easier just to talk about these. These are important, don't get me wrong, but it's almost like, many working class people, they want to know about jobs, public services, education for their kids, and as well as environmental issues. I mean, this is a nonsense to think that working class people are not interested in clean air for their kids or livable future and so on. But it relates to that issue of the language that's used often on the left. It's almost like you're going, I speak now as an educator myself, and I know you were in the academy as well yourself. You've now gone feral, though, you lucky bastard. You're able to escape it. But there's almost like that you're being preached at, and you have to learn the Marxist canon or whatever version of it you're going to talk about. Whereas the right, as you say, they are, I think, very powerful because they do something that the left is not comfortable doing in talking about emotions and talking about how people feel. Uh-huh. And I do think, and I don't even know what the answer is on the left, I'd be interested in your own reaction to this. I do think mobilizing people's anger and transforming it into injustice, and then saying, okay, where's this injustice come from? It hasn't fallen from the sky. It hasn't, you know, materialized out of nowhere. But to take people's anger, even though it may be misplaced in terms of its origins, just take it as it is and then sit down with people. That's difficult work. I'm not saying this in any way that makes it seem that it's really easy. But to take that feeling that people have, that they've been left behind, that no one cares about them, and then explain to them, well, actually, you know, the reasons for the healthcare system not being as good as it should be has got nothing to do with asylum seekers. The system was broke before any asylum seeker rocked up here. It's got to do with the underfunding by the state for decades and so on. But I'm just interested in maybe your response in terms of that. You know, how do we deal with that emotion? Because the right is very good. And of course, social media is about monetizing those high impact emotions and so on. So I'm also a little bit nervous about talking about emotions in this space, but I do think we have to address it.
No, 100%. I think in our work, I know that in our work, and if we do a lot of political education, what Trademark does, I know that fundamental to our presence in spaces where we're talking politics to people is that we get emotional, we get passionate, and people respect that and people respond to that. It's not technocratic at all. It's really, this is about me, my kids, our future, my community's future, and I get angry about that. And we always, one of the jokes on our political schools is, if you come into our political school on a Monday and you're slightly angry, by the time you leave on a Friday, you're going to be fucking livid. And rightly should be angry, but the right has kind of utilized that politics of resentment to a far greater degree than we have. And I'm going to go back to the point I made right at the start. The reason is too many on the left look like they're defending the status quo. They look like defending the current system, right? So now we've got to get fucking rid of this system. We have to talk about alternatives. And if the left don't talk about just and realistic alternatives, then, you know, progressive alternatives, and the right's going to step into that space and talk about irrational and reactionary alternatives. They won't do any of it, but that's not the point. They'll talk about it. They'll sound radical, and they'll get elected, and they'll get support, and they'll recruit. Because, you know, it's really important, isn't it, to say that phrase I keep repeating, that, you know, fascism or whatever you want to call it, it's not a working class phenomenon. It's a ruling class project. The question for us is to what extent they'll recruit from the working class to back that project. And at the moment, they're doing quite well at it, because above all, the far right want power. They're on their own. But also the centre-right want the far-right in power with them, because it defends their system, it defends neoliberalism. So the left have got to, I mean, the whole Brexit, debate, the whole debate about the European Union, about whether you're pro-EU and anti-EU, we really have to have a proper discussion and analysis of, I mean, to me, the EU is no different than CETA and TTIP and TPP and all those other mental fucking, you know, free trade agreements that allow capitalism to bestride the globe, take what it wants, make what it wants, extract what it wants, dump what it wants, and create massive profits for a tiny elite. And when you defend the EU, you defend that system. And so much of the left in Europe is defending the indefensible, because it doesn't really understand it, I don't think. So for me, that's a big part of this. We've got to break with capitalism in our analysis first, before you can even begin to discuss about what replaces it. So for me, anti-capitalism is fundamental to having that debate and having that. And as you see, I do get annoyed. I do get passionate about it. David Harvey said it really well when I shouted that. He says that, since Chile, since the, you know, the coup in the 70s, everyone thinks like a neoliberal, whether they want to or not. And I think that's so true of the left, that everyone's forgotten to think as like eco-socialists. Like you said yourself, dump GDP, start talking about growth differently, dump, you know, different kinds of metrics for how we measure the health of a society. All of that stuff's really important for us. But I think, again, I think the left is stuck in defending the indefensible, and that's why we're losing.
And I also think, just even at the level of communication, is, you know, many left-wing activists don't speak in an accent or in a way that working-class people can comprehend. I do think, and, you know, I've seen yourself and the work that Trademark have done over many years, and it's something I try and do in my own teaching, although a little bit more constrained. Yeah, but by using bad language, for example, that is an eminently reasonable and indeed authentic working, not for the sake of it, you're not just being sweary for the sake of it, but it's the way I was brought up. That was the language you used because it expressed, you know, people's emotional states and so on. And it was rough. I mean, I love the fact that trademark events always have that. There's an intellectual depth to them, but that's not foregrounded. That comes out in the natural discussion, usually based upon, okay, you know, as we all know that phrase, a concrete analysis of a concrete situation. So for me, to even at the level of just beginning to speak in a language that people understand, of even when, you know, you and I both been through the academy, we got doctorates and so on. But I just know that in our, certainly our public facing work, that's not what we're there. We're there as workers, as fathers, as husbands. And yes, you can bring in the analysis. You don't start with the analysis because I think that's so off-putting for people. It's almost like they're being back in school when they go to some left-wing organized meeting. So I think the issue of communication, the language you use, is so, so important. And I do think there is that question of emotionally connecting with the people we want to, you know, work alongside. And isn't about let's call ourselves organic intellectuals or whatever, telling working class people what it is they need to think. Is getting alongside and saying, well, what is the issue? How does the shoe hurt for you? And figure out how we can help each other.
Again, there's a thing that comes to mind, though, and it's that list of things that the far right have used so well as a tactic. They're that idea of populism, which is not so much an ideology as it is just a style of politics, to the point where the left can be characterized, as you said, as preachy, technocratic, bureaucratic, tell us what to do. They're too polite. They dress too well. They sound... And that's the elite, right? And the elite is trade unions, NGOs, the whole of fucking science, apparently. You know, everyone's in the elite, climate scientists. And then who are the people? Well, the people are real. They're authentic. They're like us. They swear. They break the status quo. They speak common sense. It truth tellers, all that bollocks. Yeah, but weirdly, Boris Johnson could be one of them. Nigel Farage could be one of them. You know, a man descended from George the fucking Third, who's an aristocrat. Boris de Pfeffel Johnson, he's a man of the people. So we know it's bollocks. But as a tactic, it works really well. And the left plays up to the characterization of being part of the elite way too often. That's the point you're making, I think. And that's the point that we always try and break that. So no, that's not, we don't belong to that left. we're fucking the authentic left. And part of that comes back to the basics of what it is you do when you go into rooms with people. Now, whether they think you're a fly by night, are you a consultant, are you one of us, are you to be trusted? And it goes back, and Sean Byers, who's listening to this, will laugh his balls off at me, but when we were developing our political education, approach to political education, we kind of went back to the rules of rhetoric by Aristotle. And he said there was three really important things when you stand up in a room and you're using rhetoric and you're talking to an audience. One is logos, content. You've got to have good content. You've got to know your stuff. We're Marxists. We teach Marxism. We do it in a way that's not overly, I don't think, overly dogmatic, you know, a little bit populist at times. Second thing is ethos. They have to trust you. They've got to like you. They've got to kind of have a relationship with you. And pathos, they've got to believe that you believe what you're saying. And you do that by being passionate in the room. Mm-hmm. And if you hit those three, again, they might not like everything you say, but the people in the room know that you're authentic or you've got a legitimate voice or you're credible. And once that's established, people relax. And you can see people relax. I can see people in the room relaxing around me going, oh, I'm going to enjoy this. I'm going to have a go at this fucker as well, by the way, but I'm going to enjoy myself. And the left doesn't do that because it's full of fucking pompous, particularly men, male fucking book Marxists who want to sound clever, be the cleverest person in the room. And that's one of our problems as well, you know. Again, back to the idea we've forgotten how to speak. I always think when I'm in a room that I go into for the first time or an audience at a lecture hall, and I think if my old man was sitting in the front row there, would he understand what I'm about to say? And if the answer is no, I change the way I say it. And to quote Einstein, you know, if you can't explain a complex idea simply, well, then you don't understand it well enough, so sit the fuck down. He didn't say that last bit. I've added that. That's really important. So, yeah, how we talk, how we educate those around us is crucial in this game. And I think we've lost that ability.
Yeah. And actually, we know this from the evidence that what people remember actually is not necessarily what you've said, the content, but actually how you made them feel. And that's something, again, it's not a replacement, you know, for having good content, but it's something that certainly in engaging in effective communication with people, it is exactly as you described there. You create an atmosphere where people can relax, that you don't have to agree with you, but it's that sense of at least respectful exchange. But it's that issue that the evidence is very, very clear. Long after you've forgotten what somebody has said, you just remember that person, how did it make you feel? Did you feel relaxed, challenged? Was it comfortable? Was it not? And so there's probably a separate podcast we can probably do in terms of, you know, using or investigating new modes of communication and so on. But the last issue I want to kind of touch upon, and I know it's something you probably have a lot to talk about, is the way in which colonialism and imperialism are alive and well, not just in terms of NATO, what's going on, the genocide in Gaza, but actually in the whole green transition in terms of the northern core in America and Europe, whether it's the very inappropriately named Inflation Reduction Act in America with Uncle Joe Biden in terms of it, you know, propelling a state-led green transition, or the European Green Deal and so on. It's around extracting resources still from the global south, you know, with lithium, cadmium and so on. And so I don't really have any thoughts about, you know, we will need these resources, you know, so what would be a non-exploitative, non-capitalist green transition that doesn't include these kind of green neo-imperialist, you know, often trade deal associated, you mentioned CETA and Mercosur and so on. They're all tied up with this in terms of these are ways of getting resources from the global south to the global north. But now we're doing it not for the old imperialist reasons. These are the new imperialist reasons that we're saving the planet.
Yeah, there's that's a huge question, isn't it? I suppose, I mean, what is capitalism? It extracts things from the earth, it turns them into commodities through the means of production, it sells them into markets and people consume, and that's how the merry go around. How do you move away from a system like that? And one of the ways I try to explain to people that we have to move away from that kind of extractive system has been green movement, the environmental movement. And you made this point right at the start. It sounds like green austerity. We have to move less, do less, do little. And to working people, that's not a fucking message they want to hear, because they've always had, they had less all their life. And now someone's, all they're hearing is, oh, we've got to have less of this. You've got to do less of that. And you can't go there and don't get on a plane. And you have to have less of this. So I think that how you explain any kind of transition, even before you know what the model is, and that's a big issue, I know, because I remember having debates with you about green steel and sustainable concrete. How do you continue with fucking 7 billion people on the planet making and building infrastructure that we need? Some of that implies extractivism. Some of that implies taking those rare earth metals out of the ground and processing them in an unenvironmentally friendly way. So there's huge issues there around production and what we produce and how we produce it. But fundamentally, the answer is those decisions have to be democratic. And that's the missing point here. So the decisions about what we produce, how we produce, and who gets it have to be democratic decisions. So that means the end of the market. That means the end of private ownership, the means of production. That means that those decisions become democratic. And one of the weird things about modern capitalism is that it's nearly killing the market system itself. It's so monopolized now. I mean, there's such a few number of corporations that control so much of what happens on the planet is that they're almost creating socialism from within. I mean, they're their own gravediggers, as Marx said. Because you're seeing a really planned system. I mean, capitalism is an extremely planned system. Each firm is obviously very, very well planned. But now even those monopolies planned. Look at the size of fucking Amazon. It's soon going to be the only retailer on the planet, isn't it? Delivering things to everybody. Now, imagine if that was a Soviet system. We'd say, well, that will never work. It's not inefficient. So a planned economy is the answer. A democratic economy is the answer. And it's the only answer. That's the thing. How you transition to that, of course, is the big question. But just the other point I was making is, yeah, how you have that conversation with people about how you transfer from this economy to this future kind of utopian economy that sounds utopian at the moment. It cannot be articulated in the language of less. It cannot be articulated in the language of austerity. It has to be articulated in the language of more. So I want more time off with my kids. I want an abundance of public housing. I want an abundance of fucking healthcare. I want an abundance of education for my kids. So we have to shift how we talk about this new economy so that it sounds better than the shitty one we're in at the moment.
That is a perfect point, I think, to end the conversation. So listen, thank you so much, Stefan, for that. This has been the ABCs of Green Politics and X for Xenophobia. The ABCs of Green Politics is part of the Left Bloc Political Education Project. Please check us out on Patreon. And we'll see you down the road. Take care.
Longer foil.
It's longer foil.